this evening and Thursday evening, going to be speaking from this book, Sri Brahma Samhita. And we'll start this evening with just a little introduction of what the book is. We'll discuss the first verse, and then we'll go a little bit of gloss over the first parts of the Sri Brahma Samhita, and then we'll begin with the first prayer, the Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. This is a BBT publication. It's a direct, unedited presentation of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's English commentary, or his purports. And Bhaktisiddhanta's English commentary is a rendering of his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Bengali commentary, which is a Bengali translation of Jiva Goswami's Sanskrit commentary. And it's interesting to read the translation of Jiva Goswami's commentary, the translation of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary, and with a nice, good dictionary in hand, reading Bhaktisiddhanta's English presentation, because one can see by doing that the parampara in action. And Jiva Goswami's Sanskrit commentary is, of course, based upon his understanding of Lord Chaitanya's teachings, which he heard from Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, his two uncles, and they directly heard from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who directly received this book in his own hand in South India at the Adi Keshava temple. If you read in Chaitanya Charitamrita the narration of Lord Chaitanya's South India tour, one of the places that he visited, way down south of the southern portions of India, below Trivandrum, is the Adi Keshava temple. There were a group of very exalted scholars who were residing there at the time, and he was engaged in Harikatha with them. And in the course of that dialogue, they disclosed this subject, Sri Brahma Samhita. And when Lord Chaitanya found that what the subject was, many things, but he made a copy. And when he returned, well, even before he returned to Puri, just before returning to Puri, he visited for the second time Ramananda Roy, the governor of Madras at the time, and he gave him a copy of Sri Brahma Samhita and Krishna Karnamrita, with the explanation that these two literatures give spiritual support or basis for all the wonderful things that Ramananda Roy discussed with Lord Chaitanya during their first meeting. So Lord Chaitanya accepted this as authorized Vedic literature. In fact, well, we'll see in just a moment. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that it's the essence of all truths of all the Vedas. I particularly wanted to study Brahma Samhita for a number of reasons, without a long explanation. From the very first Krishna conscious literature that I received was a Back to Godhead magazine when I was a university student. And in that Back to Godhead magazine, there was an article by Bhaktisiddhanta, And just to give you an idea of his language, the title of the article, The Bhagavat, Its Ontology and Morphology. I had to look it up in the dictionary. What does the title mean? And then it was a several-page article, and in short, just from reading what Bhaktisiddhanta had written, I felt my consciousness had been transcendentally transformed and elevated, like I had never experienced in my life prior to that. So from the get-go, I had a very strong appreciation for Bhaktisiddhanta and what gift he had to offer, the gifts of Krishna consciousness. Not just knowledge and, you know, big vocabulary, but Krishna consciousness. Many things happened. I found this much, much later. This letter in the letters book from Srila Prabhupada to Pradyumna. Pradyumna was a graduate from Columbia University Sanskrit College. And he was, still is, a brilliant person and Sanskrit scholar. So Prabhupada engaged him in Sanskrit things, synonyms for his books and things like that. Prabhupada called him Panditji. And Pradyumna, in 1967, had found a book, a copy of Sri Brahma Samhita, and wrote a letter to Prabhupada asking, is it okay to read it? And here's Prabhupada's reply. Brahma Samhita contains the highest of all spiritual knowledge. It's the gist of Srimad Bhagavatam, where everything about Krishna is perfectly described. One who reads Brahma Samhita very carefully and scrutinizingly can understand everything of Krishna without any fault. I recommend, therefore, that all my students read Brahma Samhita very carefully, especially because it was translated personally by my spiritual master, Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj. So that did it. There are many instructions that Prabhupada has given. You would need at least 100 lifetimes to fulfill them all. But because of my appreciation, high appreciation for Bhaktisiddhanta and this letter and a few other things, I decided to embark on studying Brahma Samhita and then sharing it with others. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Krishna Das Kaviraj is describing Lord Chaitanya's finding the Brahma Samhita, Siddhanta Shastra Nahi Brahma Samhitara Sama. There is no scripture equal to the Brahma Samhita as far as the final spiritual conclusion is concerned. Indeed, that scripture is the supreme revelation of the glories of Lord Govinda, for it reveals the topmost knowledge about Him. Since all conclusions are briefly presented in the Brahma Samhita, it is essential among all the Vaishnava scriptures. And then in the purport of this verse, Srila Prabhupada writes, he describes something like 87 different subjects that are within Brahma Samhita, and it's only 62 verses. It's in 62 verses, it's sutra-like presentation of the 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. So although it's a skinny little book, it's very heavy. And there's a lot in it, and it can be unpacked and unpacked and unpacked and unpacked. And so I'm just going to tease you a little bit with some of the contents of Sri Brahma Samhita and then encourage you, if your time permits, to hear the presentation that I'm going to be making it over Thanksgiving holiday on this subject. I've already covered last year, covered all the verses except the prayers, and that took about 28 hours, including questions. And this is now the rest of the verses, then it will easily take that much time. There's a lot. This is not comprehensive, it's introductory and summary. Start with a description. This is specifically in relation to the Govinda prayers. The Gajendra Moksha Leela, you're all familiar. Gajendra is the elephant in the picture here. And before he was Gajendra the elephant, he was King Indradumna, who was cursed by Agastya Muni that he would become an elephant because he had offended the sage unintentionally. He was engaged in meditation. The sage came to his hermitage. He didn't honor him because he was engaged in meditation. So the sage cursed him, "You're dull like an elephant, you become an elephant." He became an elephant. And this is Canto 9, Srimad Bhagavatam. Canto 9, Canto 8. 8? 8? 8? 8. Canto 8. So while bathing one time, along with many other elephants, the crocodile started chomping on his leg, and a big fight ensued, and it went on for a long, long, long time, and gradually Gajendra, the elephant, was becoming weaker and weaker, weaker and weaker, and he understood it's over, because I'm losing strength, he's in his element, I'm out of my element, it's over. So in that situation of desperation, Supersoul, Paramatma, within his heart, reminded him of the prayers that he used to recite as King Indradumna, and he began reciting those prayers. And in recitation of those prayers, he was reciting them with a lot of feeling, because the alligator chomping on his leg. And Lord Vishnu came. And when Lord Vishnu came, Gajendra wanted to honor him. But the only way he could do that was with his trunk. He grabbed the lotus and held the lotus up in the air with his trunk as an offering to Lord Vishnu. And then Lord Vishnu used his Sudarshan Chakra, that's his Sudarshan Chakra up here, released the Sudarshan Chakra and chopped off the head of the alligator. There's the Sudarshan Chakra chopping off the head of the alligator. And that looked like a pigeon, not like Garuda. And when the alligator's head was chopped from the body that was the alligator, it was Bhagavatam described previously, was a Gandharva who had been cursed to become an alligator, so his curse was now terminated, and Gajendra, doesn't say how quickly it happened, but Gajendra was liberated by the mercy of Lord Vishnu. So, and here's the demigods showering flowers in honor of Lord Vishnu's kindness to Gajendra. And in the verse, this is taken from the first verse of, what is it, Canto 8, Chapter 3. I'll just read what's at the bottom. Shukadeva Goswami continued, "Thereafter the king of the elephants, Gajendra, fixed his mind in his heart with perfect intelligence and chanted a mantra which he had learned in his previous birth as Indradumna and which he remembered by the grace of Krishna." Well, the part that I wanted to show is this. It's from his previous birth, according to Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada writes in the purport, "Gajendra was formerly King Indradumna, and somehow or other, in his next life he became king of the elephants. In fact, that's what Gajendra means. Gaja Indra, king of the elephants. When Gajendra was in danger, and although he was in the body other than that of a human being, he remembered a stotra, or the stotra he had chanted in his previous life. Yatate cha tato bhuya samsidhau kuru nandana. To enable one to achieve perfection, Krishna gives one the chance to remember him again. And then Prabhupada continues, it is imperative, therefore, that all devotees in Krishna consciousness, that's us, practice chanting some mantra. Certainly, one should chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, which is the Maha Mantra, or great mantra. And also, one should practice chanting Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu, or the Nrisingha Stotra. Yato Nrisingha Parato Nrisingho Yato Yato Yamintato Nrisingha. Every devotee, that's us, should practice in order to chant some mantra perfectly, so that even he may be imperfect in spiritual consciousness in this life. That's us. In his next life, he will not forget Krishna consciousness, even if he becomes an animal. Hopefully that won't be us. Of course, a devotee should try to perfect his Krishna consciousness in this life, for simply by understanding Krishna and his instructions, after giving up this body, one can return home back to Godhead. So this is an instruction, like the other instruction. All of my disciples should learn this. So within this Sri Brahma Samhita, there are these stotras that in all of our temples all over the world every day we're engaged in chanting, these two of them every morning. And you'll be hearing a little bit about what the significance of that is, in addition to this instruction given by Srila Prabhupada. And we'll start with the first. Well, I'll mention this. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu returned to Puri, after having given a copy of Sri Brahma Samhita to Ramananda Roy, he gave a copy to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and he gave a copy to Sarup Damodar, and it became a literature that all the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu kept and studied and learned, and because it enshrined the essential message of Lord Chaitanya, and the essential, which was the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, that has a very special significance in our Gaudiya Sampradaya. In particular, this book, Sri Brahma Samhita, according to Jiva Goswami, it's chapter 5 of 100 chapters of a larger work. What Lord Chaitanya found in Adikeshava Temple was chapter 5. And in chapter 5, the essence of the entire other 99 verses is compressed and presented here. So let's chant this verse together. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam. The translation, Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Godhead. He has an eternal blissful spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin. And he is the prime cause of all causes. In Jiva Goswami's commentary, the purport for this verse is about 30 pages long. And the reason he has such an extensive purport is because he indicates it's the Paribhasha Sutra of the text. So what does that mean? Here's the synonyms of each of these words. Just like the word parikshati, when you look around. So pari means around, bhasha means language or speech, so paribhasha, to fully speak or to explain, to define in a sutra. So in Jiva Goswami's Krishna Sandarbha, it's one of six parts of a large work, a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, he introduces this term. Paribhasha Sutra is a classic part of, commonly, a part of a larger work. And I'll just say in simple language what he says. Generally, it's a verse that appears towards the beginning of a larger text. It governs all of the other verses of that text, just like an emperor governs many kings. In that work, there may be many seemingly unrelated subjects and truths that are stated, and one may not see how they're connected to one another, but they're connected by the Paribhasa Sutra. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the verse. And so if there's something that's said later in the text, if one is not clear about it, the understanding must, it's a rule, it must be consistent with the Paribhasha Sutra. You can't screw a meaning out of a text that's not resonant with and in fidelity with the Paribhasha Sutra. So it's a very important, it's a key that opens up the treasure house. So the example that Jiva Goswami gives in Krishna Sandarbha, the Paribhasha Sutra of Srimad Bhagavatam, is this one, 1328. And mainly it's referred to in the first two lines. Ete changsha kalapungsa krishnastu bhagavan swayam. In that phrase, it indicates that Krishna, in his original form, in Goloka specifically, he's the fountainhead of all other incarnations, because chapter 3 is a list of incarnations. In fact, he's the source of everything. And as the Vedas are searching for the absolute truth, that from which everything comes, the statement of this verse is Krishna is that source of everything from which everything comes. Krishna is the absolute truth. And all the other 17,999 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam are governed by this one. And similarly, those of you that have studied Nectar Devotion, the way the Prabhupada has translated Nectar Devotion, it's the Paribhasha Sutra is concealed or is buried within the introduction. But in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, some of you are familiar with this verse, Anyabhilashata Shunyam Jnana Karma Janavratam Anukulyena Krishna Nushilanam Bhakti Rutama. Because the subject of the entire Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is about bhakti. So this is a definition of what bhakti is and what bhakti isn't. You've heard me describe this before. So this is the Paribhasha Sutra and symbol of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And similarly, this first verse of Brahma Samhita is said to be the Paribhasha Sutra of the text. So that means all of the other texts are expanding on the meaning of this one verse. And then Jiva Goswami goes on to say, and this chapter 5 is the Paribhasha chapter of the other 99 chapters. It's a heavy verse. It's a weighty message, and we'll just discuss it very briefly. It starts with the Ishvara Parama Krishna, and this word Ishvara means controller. So everyone is controlling something. And although everyone is controlling something, everyone is controlled by somebody else. We're little Ishvaras, and there's a Parama Ishvara, a Supreme Ishvara, controller of controllers. And the controller of controllers, that's Krishna. At the same time, Krishna is not controlled by anyone. So he's up at the top here. He is the controller of controllers. Lord Brahma, who's the creator of the universe, even in the second canto, Narada Muni got a little confused and thought, Brahma, what are you doing meditating? I thought you're it. You're the topmost person. You're the creator of the universe. Is there somebody above you? Because you're meditating on something or someone. So Brahma says, yeah, my power to create comes from Krishna. Although he's a controller, he's controlled by a superior controller. And then once the universe is created, there are demigods who are controlling the universal affairs, but their ability to control the universal affairs and the universe itself that they're controlling, they worship Lord Vishnu and their power comes from him. Here's a nice pushkar painting where the demigods are at the shore of the milk ocean and the Lord is in it. Svetadvip, the island in the midst of the milk ocean, and they're offering their prayers, Purusha Sukta prayers, in honor of Lord Vishnu, who is the controller of the controllers. Lord Indra, after his terrible offense to Krishna and the residents of Vrindavan with the downpour of rain for 7 days and seven nights in Vrindavan trying to kill everybody, he comes before Krishna and offers his worship to Krishna. Lord Brahma, similarly, after the Brahma Vimohan Lila, he offers his prayers to Krishna. So there's no exception. Krishna is the controller of all controllers. Second line, Sachit Ananda Vigraha. Now this is very important. Vigraha, in the sense that the absolute truth has form. And the second is, the form is not a material form. So we're not used to, when we think of form, we think of material. And so impersonalists go in the direction of, well, the absolute must be without form because form means material. They can't go the next step and say, well, there's such thing as forms that aren't material. They're unable to do that. But Brahma Samhita is declaring very emphatically the form of the Lord is Sat and Chit and Ananda. Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. And that's what is made of. His transcendental form, and not only his form, the whole of Goloka and all of the other living beings that are emanations from him. Then comes this contradiction, just like this word, Adir, and then Anadir, Govinda. So he's the original, and he has no other origin. And of those 30 pages of Jiva Goswami's commentary, something like 12 of them are just on this word Govinda. What's the significance of this word Govinda? Because he's already spoken Krishna. Ishvara Parama Krishna. So Govinda specifically refers to that feature of the Supreme Lord that is the original, from whom all others come, and he, that original, is in Goloka. Govinda in Goloka, and Gopal, and so it's the realm of many, many cows. When the last time I was here in St. Louis, we had that little gathering at Krishna House, and the Christian Science girl was there, and I was telling her, well, you know, it was nice. Did I share this with you, that dialogue? No? Do it another time, because it'll take too long. Really nice expression, but because I grew up in a Christian family, but I never was acquainted much with Christian Science, or Christian scientists, because they're like this very small, numerically, small group. But I knew one person. I know that they have very strong ideas. So I wanted to hear from her. Why don't you say what Christian Science says, and I'll say what Krishna says. Just, you know, compare like that. So, I'll do it a little quickly. She said, well, Christian Science says that our real identity is not the covering of the soul, it's the soul within, and that the covering or the human form is to give the soul as a very special opportunity to achieve the highest potential of consciousness of the soul. It's that perfect match. And if you do not achieve the highest potential of consciousness of the soul, then when the body's finished, you get another body. So reincarnation is part of their conviction also. That's fantastic. So I ask, what's that fullest state of consciousness? What is it? Well, it is consciousness of the Supreme. I said, okay, great. And what's the Supreme? Well, it's got definition by negation. Well, it's not this. Okay. What is it? And how do you know that you're there? Just like, how do we know that we're here? We have a body. We have form. We have senses. We're here. So when you're in that state of higher consciousness, how do you know? I was seeking to find out if she was an impersonalist or a personalist. Is there form in the state of pure consciousness? Well, it was not clear to her. You know, maybe the minister of Christian Scientists, it would be clear to him. Maybe not also. I said, well, all of this is very, very close, but there is, what Krishna says is there is a place for those living entities, just like for living entities that don't achieve the highest state of consciousness, one continues to come back and get, you know, the opportunity at least to attain that. And when you've attained that, there's a place. And the place is called Goloka. And literally, Goloka means planet of cows. She said, no. I said, yes, why no? You know, Krishna likes cows. She said, no. why can't he like cows? Not cows. I said, well, not cows like this. These are spiritual cows with spiritual form, and they're surabhi cows. We'll hear some more about it in just a bit. And they love Krishna, and Krishna loves them. And, you know, they have no claws, they have no teeth, they have sharp teeth. They're very kind and gentle, and so is Krishna. And they love Krishna, and Krishna loves them. So that's Goloka. And in Goloka, Krishna is enjoying with not only the cows, he's enjoying with all the eternal, perfectly pure and loving associates. And that's the, it's, so this, that's the Govinda, the import of the word Govinda is the original form of this, the source of all things. An Adir Adir. Govinda. Krishna in his abode in Goloka. So, in comparison or in contrast to the Supreme Lord of Vaikuntha. Because it's the same Supreme Lord, but that Lord is Narayana and this Lord is Govinda. Anadir Adir Govinda. Vyasadeva meditating on Krishna as the cause of all causes and all incarnations, all expansions of him. That's this third chapter of the first canto. And then that's the first verse. Now, as the verses 3 through 5 start to unfold, real quick gloss, there's a presentation on the realization of Lord Brahma of the spiritual world, Goloka. And in that spiritual world, Goloka, and the process that was applied by Lord Brahma, which is described in further verses, but it mentions, those of you that have read Brahma Samhita, mentions a yantra. This is a yantra. Those of you who have been to Mayapur, how many have been to Mayapur? Oh, okay. And in Mayapur, there's the Nrisinga altar. And you look at the Nrisinga deity, and just at his feet, there's all these Shalagram Shilas. Then over to our left is Prahlad. And just on the left and the right, below the Shalagram Shilas, there's yantras, a brass plate, two of them. And it's depicting on the brass plate in Sanskrit letters the abode of Lord Nrisingadeva. And this is not a Nrisinga yantra, this is a Govinda yantra, and here it is drawn out with the Sanskrit terms, and here it is with all of those terms presented in English. Well, not English, in Roman letters. And in short, it's a depiction of Goloka. And the lines that you just saw showing up here are words of a mantra. There's two mantras. Here is the Bija mantra, Kleem, and then around the inside is a six-sided, created by these inverted triangles, a six-sided figure called a hexagon, means six-sided. And in that six-sided figure on the inside, that's the abode of Radha and Krishna. Here's maybe you've seen this poster. It's the same design. This is Goloka. And in the central part, here's the six-sided mantra. And there's Radha and Krishna in the middle. And according to Brahma Samhita, I'm just summarizing these verses 3 through 5. Outside, there's petals, and the petals are the abodes of the gopis. And you keep going, and there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, it's a big lotus, abodes of other associates of Krishna. It's Krishna in Vrindavan and his associates. It's Goloka. And then it goes on to say there, outside that, there's the suburbs. It doesn't say suburbs. There's a quadrangular region. That's means four-sided. There it is. And in this four-sided quadrangular region, there's Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, and there's the Mathura and Dwarka regions. So sometimes you've heard this stated, that when Krishna performs his pastimes in this world, there are three principal places: Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka. It's said that because that's Goloka. And there's the upper, I'm pointing up in the sky, the Goloka in the spiritual world, and the place where Krishna performs his pastimes here is none different. Gokula was one way to make the distinction between the two. But it has all these parts. And there's many other parts that are described in those other verses in the earlier section. So the process of realizing everything that Brahma realized was based upon the same thing that we do, mantra chanting. So it, after a number of verses that we just skipped that describe the unfolding of the creation to the point where Lord Brahma appears on the lotus, coming from the navel of Garbhadakshay Vishnu, he's on this lotus, and it's dark in all directions. Can't turn on a light, no, you know, candle, no sun, nothing. It's just darkness in all directions. He sees the lotus, he uses his rational faculty that says, well, if I find where the stem of this lotus originates, I'll find where I came from. So he starts climbing down the stem and down 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 and doesn't find the end of the stem. Then he realizes, well, I'm not going to find out that way. And then he hears these syllables, ta-pa, right? Three times. Then he knows what that means. He's supposed to do tapasya. But the tapasya that he does is described here in Brahma Samhita. He, from the original goddess of learning Saraswati, the divine consort of the Supreme Lord, the purport explains, this isn't the goddess Saraswati that people go to worship before they take their exams in India. That's a different one. That's an expansion of her. And because this is before there's even a universe, what to speak of an exam. This is the internal potency of the Supreme Lord, that one. So Radharani, or the original internal potency of the Supreme Lord Saraswati, said to Brahma, O Brahma, this mantra, which is that hexagonal mantra within the abode of Krishna, will assuredly fulfill your heart's desire. Well, that could be a problem if you have material desire. And by the way, this mantra can do both, if you have spiritual desire and material desire. So he chanted this mantra for a long time. Not just 16 rounds a day. He chanted this mantra nothing but, because there wasn't anything to do, for 1,000 celestial years. And following that, and there's the six-sided cleam in the middle. This is Radha and Krishna. And you read the purport, and Bhakti Siddhanta identifies each of these six sides and the syllables that they mean. The syllables, what do they mean? What message do they convey? And that's what he meditated upon, the mantra, while visualizing this yantra, because the yantra is the abode of Krishna. It's Goloka. Krishna in, or Govinda in Goloka. And after that, that was verse 24, he then heard the sound of Krishna's flute entering into his ear, and then from his mouth came another mantra, Kama Gayatri mantra, and then we're at verse 28, where it says, enlightened by the recollection of that Gayatri, embodying the three Vedas, Brahma became acquainted with the expanse of the ocean of truth. That means absolute truth. He realized Krishna. Then he worshipped Sri Krishna, the essence of all the Vedas, through this hymn. So some of you may have attended, or if you didn't attend, you heard the recordings of the seminar we had in Gita Nagari on exploring Guru Tattva. And one of the classes that I gave was explaining what happens when initiation takes place, specifically when mantra is given. When mantra is given, or mantra diksha takes place, two things happen. Same as in this verse. Divyam jnanam yato dadyat kuryat papasya sangshaya is the Sanskrit verse, but the two things that happen with divyam jnanam is one can understand who oneself is. Here's Bhakti Siddhanta's language. Brahma thought thus within himself. By recollection of the Kama Gayatri, it seems to me that I am the eternal maidservant of Krishna. He understood his rasa. Not, you know, the material part is he's going to create a universe. He hasn't done it yet. But inside, or his spiritual identity is conjugal rasa, internal maidservant of Krishna. He goes on, though the other mysteries in regard to the condition of the maidservant of Krishna were not revealed to him, at least yet, it will happen gradually. Brahma, by dint of his searching self-consciousness, became well acquainted with the ocean of truth. That is the truth of Krishna. So these are the two things. Through chanting of mantra, these two things are the essence to be derived. Self-realization and God-realization. And the clearing of anything else. Or anything else is to be seen in terms of those two. And then the very next verse, this is 28, the very next verse is the first of the Govinda prayers. So we'll just cover the first of the Govinda prayers quickly this evening, and we'll continue again Thursday. So it should be that we'll hear Mahatma singing, if all the technology works properly. No, it's not working properly. Okay, there we go. This is Lord Brahma's jubilation, his exalting the realization that he has of Krishna. I mean, part of the reason for showing you those yantras and things, that's the abode of Krishna in a form or in a manner of worship. You know, we have deity worship. Brahma didn't have a deity. He had a yantra. And when we do deity worship, we also chant mantra. He had a mantra. So the system was different. But the essence is not different. And the consequence is not different. the awakening of Krishna consciousness is the essence. So he's here in this verse revealing his realization of Goloka. And here's the translation. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, the first progenitor who is tending the cows, yielding all desire, in abodes built with spiritual gems, surrounded by millions of purpose trees, always served with great reverence and affection by hundreds of thousands of Lakshmis or gopis. In his purport of text 31, so 29, 30, and 31, the first three of the Govinda prayers are a group, a little group. And he explains, the first one is describing the abode of the Supreme Lord. And the next one is describing the form of Govinda. And the third verse is describing the amorous pastimes of Govinda, the embodiment of his 64 excellences. So, the abode of Krishna, the form of Krishna, and the pastimes of Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. So we're starting with the abode of Krishna. In the abode of Krishna, there are very special opulences that we're accustomed to hearing about Vaikuntha as the transcendental realm where the opulences of Lord Narayana are just overwhelmingly outstanding. It's, in fact, the mood is Aishwarya Bhav, the mood of opulence, Aishwarya, the mood of opulence. And a very nice pastime in Chaitanya Charitamrita that illustrates this is found in the section where the Rath Yatra pastime of Lord Jagannath takes place. So after, I'm going quickly, so please excuse me for not making all the little connections so nicely, but when after Lord Jagannath and Subhadra and Balaram have their Snanyatra, the bathing festival, and then they disappear for 2 weeks, and then they come out of the temple, are mounted on the chariot, and they go down the grand road to the Gundicha temple. They stay there. There's a return Rath Yatra 8 days later. On the fifth day, each of the days there's another festival, festival and festival. So one of the festivals is called Hera Panchami. And Hera Panchami is where Lakshmi, who's been waiting patiently and she's getting a little impatient for Lord Jagannath to come back, she comes out of the temple and she's in a haughty mood. She's dressed in the most opulent of garments and jewels, and she's placed on a palanquin of jewels, and her attendants are dressed very opulently with weapons studded with jewels, weapons, and they, you know, the beating of the drums and the blaring of the trumpets and coming down the road from the Jagannath temple, demanding that Jagannath comes back. She's like, you know, a wife that's been stood up by her husband. She's not going to, you know, just take it. She's, you come back. And with the sticks, I don't know how it happens. I don't think anybody gets hurt, but they beat the attendants of Jagannath in order. You bring Jagannath back now. It's a big festival. So Lord Chaitanya's associates are standing by the side of Grand Road watching Lakshmi go charging, you know, towards the Gundija temple in her mood. And Srivas sees this and he becomes jubilant. He said, just see the opulence of the goddess of fortune. In Vrindavan, the opulence is what? They have some trees and they go gather some flowers and some fruits and they make these little offerings to Krishna. But my goddess of fortune, she rides in a palanquin of jewels. When we were in Tirupati, we had our midterm meeting in Tirupati, or GBC, and the temple president, Revati Raman, has a very strong relationship with the temple. He arranged for not even just VIP darshan, but, you know, VIP darshan. I think he had to pay a little money to get it. But one of the days, he went with a smaller group. He said that the deities were wearing a special outfit that's worth, like, you know, many millions of dollars. It's just it's an outfit with rubies and diamonds and just like one dress. That's, you know, one of the days of the year. Very opulent deity. Very opulent. And the darshan they had, they were able to stand there not for like 3 seconds, but, you know, like 5 minutes. You can't do that. Can't do that. They did that. You know, with the mantras being chanted and the whole thing, just watching the procedure. So, when Lord Chaitanya heard Srivas getting so, she started dancing, jumping, and, you know, my God, is a fortune. He said, Srivas, you sound just like Narada Muni. Because he's Narada Muni, who has a special appreciation for the opulence of the Lord of Vaikuntha. Then Lord Chaitanya turned to Surup Damodar and said, Surup Damodar, can you speak something about the opulence of Vrindavan? Educate Srivas a little bit. So he, Surup Damodar, spoke some verses, one of them is quoted here, that's essentially paraphrasing this verse 29, and then the final verse of the prayers, it's verse 56. Shriya Kanta Kanta, that verse. So, here's from Chaitanya Charitamrita, and you see the Sanskrit, it's similar. Chintamanis, Charana Bhushanam, Angananam. The anklets of the damsels of Vrajabhumi are made of Chintamani stone. He was saying, the goddess of fortune is riding in a palanquin made of jewels. But in Vrindavan, the gopis, their anklets are made of jewels. In fact, there's many verses, some of the, when they have shoes, they, for the little piece that goes through between the big toe and the one next to it, they use Chintamani placed there. Sometimes they use big Chintamani stones to as a doorstop to hold the door open so that when Krishna's coming back, they can look out their door and see Krishna coming back. And it goes on and on. Very wonderful prayers by our acharyas about the Chintamani. The trees are wish-fulfilling trees. And they produce flowers with which the gopis decorate themselves. There are also wish-fulfilling cows, kamadhenus, which deliver unlimited quantities of milk. These cows constitute the wealth of Vrindavan, thus Vrindavan's opulence is blissfully exhibited. And there are many verses. This is just one of them. I picked this one because there's, just as in verse 29, it mentions Chintamani and Kalpavriksha and Surabhi cows, wish-fulfilling cows. The opulence of Vrindavan, essentially, he's saying that in Vrindavan, just about everything can supply just about anything. In one of these sets of pictures, there's a painting of Janmadagni, the father of Lord Parashuram. He had a kamadhenu, and he was visited by Kartavirya Arjuna, powerful king, really proud guy, and lots of followers, his own entourage. So Janmadagni wanted to feed him, but here he's living in a little cottage out in the forest. So he approached his kamadhenu, and his kamadhenu provided a big feast. It's not, so not just milk, but anything. Unlimited anything. And the trees. It's not just they supply fruits, or they supply fruits of any variety and any quantity at any time of the year. But they produce anything at any time. And the Chintamani will be approaching this. But what Srup Damodar was saying is, you know, the opulence of the goddess of fortune and this palanquin of jewels is nothing. The earth is jewels. The building materials for the buildings is jewels. Everything is, and those jewels are, they can fulfill all desire. Srivas was very happy to be defeated. He again started jumping and clapping his arms. Chintamani prakara sadnasu kalpa briksha. Bhaktisiddhanta's language is, just as Maya builds the mundane universe with the five material elements, so the spiritual chit potency has built the spiritual world of transcendental gems. So one might wonder, well, if just about everything can produce just about anything, then why don't people live in big palaces and have big fancy clothes and ornament? You know, like, why isn't it like, you know, gaudy? It's very simple. Why? And it has to do with the quality of the love of the residents in Vrindavan. Whatever they want is whatever Krishna wants, and whatever Krishna wants isn't gaudy. It's the particular mood of Vrindavan. It's the love of the cows and the love of the intimacy of loving associates. And so they only want what Krishna wants, and Krishna, the simple natural things is what Krishna wants. You're perhaps familiar with the sparsha money. Sparsha means touch. So the touchstone, where the touchstone, when you touch the touchstone to base metal, it becomes gold. But this isn't sparsha money, it's another type of a jewel that literally chinta money, a thought gem. So whatever it is that you desire, the chinta money provides it. And again, everything is made up of chintamani. You know, the chairs that you sit on, and the floor that you walk on, it's inconceivable. The comment is made, great saintly persons like Akrura, They roll in the dust of Vrindavan. This is the dust of my Lord's lotus feet. And then the trees. So when I make this presentation, I'm going to read from the writings of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and other of our acharyas, Prabodhananda Saraswati. There's a whole chapter in Prabodhananda Saraswati's writings about trees in Vrindavan. And it's, the poetry is just excellent. Anyway, the purpose tree yields only the fruits of piety, wealth, fulfillment of desire, and liberation. The Vedas are compared to a purpose tree. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha is fulfilled through the Vedas. But the purpose trees in the abode of Krishna bestow innumerable fruits, and here's Bhaktisiddhanta's language, in the shape of checkered divine love, meaning they fulfill the desires of rasa and in the most intimate form. Checkered mean variegated, not just, you know, homogeneous, but full of variety of love, and the trees assist the living entities in fulfilling the happiness of love for Krishna. And then the Surabhi cows, Lakshavriteshu Surabhir Avipalayantam. There's lots of cows. Moo. Kamadenus, cows yielding the fulfillment of desire, give milk when they're milked. But the Kamadenus of Goloka pour forth oceans of milk in the shape of the fountain of love, showering transcendental bliss that does away with the hunger and thirst of all pure devotees. Kind of unimaginable. This is from the churning of the ocean of milk where Surabhi is produced, but it's not like, you know, that's just a lila where she is produced. In the spiritual world, she's eternally existing and it's not just one Surabhi cow. Unlimited numbers. And not just giving milk, but love showering transcendental bliss. Here's this painting of Janmadagni, that the Surabhi cow was being taken away by Kartavirya Arjuna. And when Parashuram came back, he was a little upset. He went and chopped up Kartavirya Arjuna and all of his soldiers. But Janmadagni was able to get anything and everything from one Kamadena, what to speak of unlimited numbers of them. All cows in Vraja are Surabhi cows. That's the nature of the place. And Krishna loves them, and they love Krishna very much.
We should not think of what Krishna's doing in Goloka as like people that take care of dairies do in this world. This is a reflection of that, but what that is, it shouldn't be confined to what this is. Like that, you know, the girl at WashU that was saying, no, can't have cows. Why not? Well, it's not like this. Well, of course it's not like this, but anyway. He's disclosing, Brahma in this prayer is disclosing what the abode of Krishna is like. Lakmi sahasrashata sambrahma sevyamanam. In Vaikuntha, here we see this depiction of eight different forms of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, the bestower of all fortune. And then above this Haridam or Vaikunthadam, there's Dwarka. And in Dwarka, Krishna not just had 16,000 goddesses of fortune who were his expansions, residing in each one of Krishna's different 16,000 palaces. But in Goloka, there's hundreds of thousands of such goddesses of fortune, all of whom are expansions of Srimati Radharani, and at the center of all of them, their happiness is simply serving the happiness of Radha, whose happiness is the pleasure of Krishna. So this verse 29 is giving us a picture of the abode of Krishna, Govindam, Adi Purusham, Tamaham Vajami. And that's a short version. So, we'll continue Thursday and cover those other two verses, the form of Krishna and the pastimes of Krishna. And those, just to like a little going forward, after those three verses, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes that Lord Brahma realizes that worldly people won't understand the transcendental nature. Either they just won't understand it at all, or they'll think, oh, this is fanciful imagination of somebody got a little carried away and started describing something in their imagination. So that those doubting types of persons can understand how Krishna does what he does and how he has his form like he has and how his abode is as it is, he gives then four verses that explain how it is so. Then it continues. You know, after following that section, it's you put those pieces together and here's the nature of the residents of Goloka, where they're filled with love for Krishna. And then you start going more deeply into the nature of the types of love that exist in Goloka for Krishna. And then it starts getting, you know, really profound. So these are, it's step by step by step, taking one into the spiritual world, into the truths about Krishna. It's really fascinating. So any questions or comments from this evening? Yes?
You asked the question and answered it. How come everything's not gaudy in Goloka? Because Krishna likes it simple. So in terms of deity worship, I understand that the essence is trying to offer with love. There's two choices to make, you know. You can, especially while serving Gaurnathaya deities like we do, it seems Gaurnathaya like simple. Their mood is simple, but at the same time, you know, when the curtain opens, we want persons to be
breathless. Well, what Prabhupada said is our worship in the beginning is not on the spontaneous platform, it's on the regulative platform. And on the regulative platform, we worship in the mood of on reverence. So on reverence is invoked by splendor. And so we worship in that way. When very elevated persons become situated in spontaneous love of God, that mood, their mood may change. And as their mood changes, then their expression of their worship may change. And then again, it may not. It may, you know, they may worship for the benefit of those who are, you know, it depends on the situation. They may continue to exhibit the worship in opulence, but internally they're appreciating something else. Like Lord Chaitanya seeing Lord Jagannath, saw Krishna holding a flute. You know, we don't need to worry about that right now. We worship in an opulent way. Nice ornaments, nice dress, nice garlands, nice crown. Ooh. Like that. And so it's, for householders, deity worship is a very nice way where whatever it is that one has that is opulence, that goes to the deity. Whether it's, you know, in your home or in the temple, either, same principle. You know, something that's of great value, that goes to the deity. Something that's gold, so it goes to the deity. Yeah, like that. It's for the benefit of the worshiper to see that, you know, the best goes to the deity, goes to Krishna, or Lord Chaitanya, Gaura Nitai. The best goes to them. So the best of the foods, and the best of flowers, and the best of the best. Whatever one's means permits. And there's a happiness in, of love, in making such offerings. And then there's a reciprocation with that offering of love. And when that's the happiness of deity worship. There's a reciprocation. Those who do deity worship in a serious and a regular way, there's a reciprocation. One develops some attachment for your deity, and the deity develops some attachment for you. And it helps one progress. Maintaining a consciousness of fixed mind upon, because every day, and then the next day, and then the next day, in a very regulated way, one serves the deity. Your children will grow up, but the deities don't. They'll go off and, you know, be on their own someday. And your deity will still be with you. Yes.
So, after hearing the mantra from the Saraswati, Goddess Saraswati, Lord Brahma started to chant that mantra, and then he realized his.
No, no. After the second mantra, then he realized what you just said.
So, my question is, he realizes that there is a Supreme Lord Krishna, that I am his eternal servant, means like he is able to see the Lord gives his darshan, or he's just understanding by chanting the mantra.
Is the distinction clear to you? Because in your question, it's not clear to me.
My question is: does he see the Lord Krishna, and how does he know that Lord Krishna is the Supreme? Just by chanting.
He became acquainted with the ocean of truth. That truth was imparted on. Hene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye. The truth was imparted to him. How does he know it was truth? Because it was imparted to him. One answer to your question is, how do you know when you've had enough to eat? You feel full. There's a verse in Srimad Bhagavatam that says essentially that. Through the process of hearing, like in his case, hearing mantra, three things happen. You're familiar with the verse. Just as with the eating process, if you're even fasting for some time, and then you break your fast. So three things happen. The hunger that you are feeling from fasting goes away. One feels strength coming back in the body. And one feels satisfied. At a certain point, you know, someone can say, would you like some more? And you say, now, how do you know? How do you know? How do you know you're full? You feel full. Like that, the sense of bhakti, I wish to serve the Supreme Lord. And there's nothing else. Para Isha Anubhav, great feelings for the Supreme. The desire to serve, great feelings for the Supreme. And nothing else. Viraktira Nyatracha. Those, they're symptoms. That's how he knew.
But he never sees the lawn. It's so dark.
Why do you say that? He's describing him. He's describing him and his abode and his pastimes. He's well acquainted with the ocean of truth. So why are you saying he doesn't see him? His seeing is not like our seeing. That's another verse. Premanjana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena. He's seeing. Not like our seeing. All right? Okay. Something? Yes?
Maharaj, is there any whereabouts of the remaining 99 chapters?
No. Missing. Anything else?
Right.
Yes?
He
got it?
In Travancore, in Kerala.
In Adikeshava temple.
Yeah, Adikeshava. Were they practicing before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu found that? Or?
They just had it as a scripture. It doesn't give any detail more than that. It just says that the priests had a copy. He discovered that they had the copy, and he made a copy of the copy. They didn't give him the original. A copy of the copy, and then he made other copies. But it doesn't say how they used it, just, you know, they had a scripture in their library. He, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, understood the significance of it. Presumably, more deeply than they did. And that, you know, so he became particularly attracted, and he incorporated it amongst his followers. I mean, after all, Jiva Goswami is off in Vrindavan. He brought it back to Puri, Kavur, and then to Puri, and here's Jiva Goswami writing a commentary in Vrindavan. And, you know, obviously it was taught by Jiva Goswami to his, so, It took on a special importance amongst Lord Chaitanya's followers because Lord Chaitanya invested so much value in it and because of what's in it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers are the ones who really understood this?
Yes, 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 yes. Sri Vaishnavas are also aware of it. Sri Vaishnavas are aware of it. They have their explanation of how it became manifest. To them it has its importance. But the importance is a different kind of importance. Our importance is, specifically, Goloka. you know, the unique position of Goloka above Haridam. The mood of love of Goloka above the mood of love of Vaikuntha. For Gaudiya Vaishnavas, there's special significance, and it's very, very clear. So I don't know, I haven't had a discussion with Sri Vaishnavas, how they regard those sections.
That's why I asked the question, whether they regard this as a scripture and use it and propagate it. That's
but it's just like, it's just like anything else. You know, people, according to one's mood of love, they'll see something. How they see the deity, how they see the scripture, how they see the process of chanting. From, you know, from the line of predecessor acharyas one receives. Yes? Yeah. The past, for example, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna are within the Padma Purana and Vishnu Purana. And the regard of other sampradayas is not the same as the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Well, the Pushti, you know, some have some special appreciation also of the uniqueness of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. Anyway. But there's a different appreciation because of the lineage and the gift specifically that Lord Chaitanya gave was unique. And so reading the same passages, the followers of Lord Chaitanya have a particular appreciation according to the line from which they received. Others say, for example, they have special appreciation for the Bal Leela of Krishna. Because he doesn't do things like rasa dance and, you know, illicit things. He just, you know, the affection of parental love for the innocent, pure Bal Gopal. They seem like that.
Only after reading Prabhupada books, I felt that I'm really reading the scripture because Prabhupada really emphasizes the real core verses, you know, like karma, you know, artha, moksha, that kind of.
Yeah. Yes.
All the other people do emphasize that, but yes. Prabhupada emphasizes more on this side.
Yes. Well, and also more, not only more on this side, but when you listen to these Brahma Samhita verses, especially when we get into like verses 36 and verses 37, it's really delicate subject matter. It's, you know, Krishna's affairs with the gopis. You know, that topic that most people hit a wall when it comes to Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. You know, they have a problem with it. So maybe, or they're attracted to the wrong way. So it's right there in Brahma Samhita. We'll see. We get there. Yes.
I'm not very clear about yantra.
Yantra. Go ahead, ask your question.
So it's a pictorial representation of a mantra, but is it, you know, drawn for our understanding?
It's literal. Just like a deity is the form of Krishna. Yantra is the abode of the Supreme Lord. It's taken that way in the process of worship, as the deity is taken as Krishna himself. Yes, literal. Like, you know, like the Bhagavatam is Krishna in its literary form. So the yantra is the abode of Lord Srinagar, depending on which yantra, the abode of the Supreme Lord in this form. He's there. And it's part of the process of worship. Prabhupada never introduced that particular method for us, so we don't do that. But apparently Lord Brahma, because he describes it. Tamal Krishnamurti, in his explanation, he calls it a mystical diagram. Literally, yantra means machine. Yantra rudhani mayaya, the machine made of the material energy. The living entity is situated on a machine. So that's, you know, another type of a yantra. It's a mystical diagram, a depiction in, you know, three-dimensional form of the abode of Krishna. And he's Radha and Krishna at the center. You know, the picture is filled out. Verses 3 through 5. And it's really complex because it's the abode of the Supreme Lord and all the different parts of, or not the essential parts of the Supreme Lord's abode.
So, like, you showed some yantras today, and then last year in your Brahma Samhita seminar also there were some yantras.
Same ones.
And so, like, one of them was the abode of Lord Nrisimha, one is
I only mentioned it. I didn't show a picture of the Nrisimha Yantra. I mentioned it. You know, I showed the picture of last year. Here's the Nrisimha altar. Over here and over here are the Nrisimha Yantras. And this one is a Govinda Yantra. It's the abode of Lord Govinda, Goloka.
So there were multiple yantras that were depicting the same Goloka.
It's just like we have different paintings of Krishna. So which one is really what Krishna looks like? They're all like what Krishna looks like. So which yantra is the real, you know, the real yantra? They're all real yantras because the essential elements are there. One is in brass. Another is in Sanskrit, another is in Roman letters with diacritics, another is an artist's rendering on a poster. When I was in Guyana, they have a yantra up on the ceiling. I asked the person who made the design, Chidandi is his name, and then another person, Prem. They saw this thing and they thought, oh, that would be nice on the ceiling. But it's a yantra. It doesn't have the mantra inscribed in it, but everything else is there. Yes.
Today, and then one of the slides you were showing, Gajendra Moksha, where you were specifying the point, like one strength is like he's not in fullness of his strength if it is not his territory or his region, right?
Yes.
So, like, we as a soul, we don't belong to this material world. We identify that. But then when we try to propagate this message of Krishna consciousness, when we try to take to other people belong into the same material world, we sometimes feel weaker, like no matter how much we try to invite them to temple or try to give the message of Krishna, we fail in this mission. So we don't feel like powerful, or we feel like we are getting weaker and weaker. That time, at that mood, they don't belong here either, but then we feel weaker. How do we regain our strength there? Like, Gajendra, he gains his strength after he surrenders to Krishna, and then Krishna appears and gives his strength. But, like, we, how do we regain our strength at such a situation?
Very thoughtful question. Very nice question. I'll respond a little differently than you might expect, though. The weakness that you described may very well or even probably comes from thinking of oneself in the doer consciousness as opposed to the instrument consciousness. By that I mean, okay, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to go do it. That's the doer consciousness. I've got this message of Krishna and here I go, giving the message of Krishna consciousness. And that's not how the message of Krishna consciousness is effectively distributed. The message of Krishna consciousness, on the other hand, is as Krishna's instrument, as the bearer of Krishna's message, like Prabhupada gives this example of a postal peon. You've heard that example? You would in your home, you have somebody comes and delivers the mail. So that's a postal peon. Peon is like it's a demeaning term. It's like this insignificant peon. So, you know, there's this big post office and I work for the post office. I get a bag that has letters and I go deliver the letters to people's homes. That's all I do. It's not like my letter. It's somebody's letter to somebody else, and I'm just delivering somebody's letter to somebody else. I'm a postal peon. Like that, Prabhupada describes the deliverer of Krishna's message. But the post office person has the whole post office standing behind them. Like if somebody does some damage, if they tamper with a postal box, the federal government is after them. Not like that the postal peon, but the government. It's a federal crime. You tamper with a post office box. So, although he's a little guy, he's got this big authority behind him. Similarly, the deliverer of Krishna's message can be, you know, really little. That's okay. The message is big, and the person from whom the message is coming is big. So, I'm the postal peon. When you're trying to give the message, just be in the mood of service. And if people, you know, respond favorably, it's not because of you. If people respond negatively, it's not because of you. If people don't even respond, it's not because of you. When the Cowherd boys, who were intimate associates of Krishna, went to ask the Brahmanas, Krishna and Balaram are hungry, can you give them something to eat? They didn't say no, they didn't say yes, they just ignored them. That's in Goloka. In the Cowherd boys. So you take the message of Krishna and deliver it to some people and they just ignore you. It's not like you didn't do it right or so the feeling weakness is an ego thing. It's not a spiritual thing. It's the approach needs to change, not the service needs to change. The consciousness behind the service needs to change. I'm just the deliverer of Krishna's message. And they can say yes, no, or maybe, or ignore me. And that's okay. I mean, try going on book distribution. It's a fantastic way to learn humility. Because, you know, it's not when people say yes, it's because, you know, you're good. Or people say no, it's because you're bad. You're just there to do a service. And some people are going to say yes and some people are going to say no. And so it's not an ego mission, it's a service. A deliverer of this transcendental message in the form of a book. And it's very purifying. It very quickly cleanses the heart of the doership mentality, instead replacing it with the instrument of the will of our disciplic succession, specifically our founder Acharya and his transcendental writings. Just like what I'm going to be doing when I'm done here. We bought some copies of this from the temple. I just got inspired because I've spent anywhere between 250 and 300 hours preparing for this presentation, as I did, you know, similarly with the other one for the last year. So I'm filled up to the top with this wonderful subject matter, and I'm really enthusiastic to share it because it's so wonderful. And part of it is, so there, here's Bhakti Siddhanta in your hand. Here's his association. I'd like to give it to others. And if you have a copy, find, you know, somebody that you think maybe could appreciate hearing the seminar, give them a copy, and then they follow along. Oh, that's what he was meaning when he wrote this and that. The whole, the spiritual world can open up. It's you know, being the deliverer of the message. And do it the other way, and then one may feel weakness. You do it in the deliverer of the message way, just the postal peon method, and it's, you feel full. So there's the answer to your question. Change the consciousness behind how you extend, not get weakened and now you have to like go plug in to the battery charger or something. Receive and give that which you have received liberally in, and you know, just pass it on. And then the heart becomes cleansed, ego becomes, you know, is dissipated, and it's just Krishna's message being passed on. We just become conduits for Krishna's message, or an instrument of delivering Krishna's message. And you feel the Krishna connection. There's where the strength is. The feeling weakness is you got in the way. I mean, ego got in the way. I'm the doer. That's the weakness. Anything else? Okay. 9:20. Lens.
Kumar and Joelle, we're trying not to be the doers. We also have to take responsibility for our inadequacies in doing that service. And there's so many, you know, as we're doing that service, they're coming out. And
Krishna knows. He's still inviting your service. Take responsibility. It's not Krishna's fault. So you take responsibility, but nonetheless you make the offering of service. Like Prahlad offers in his prayers, or Prabhupada in one of the very famous episodes of his installation of Rukmini Dwarkadish, one feels unqualified to make offerings. My dear Lord, I'm not qualified. I'm rotten, I'm fallen, I'm puffed up. But please, you accept. We take responsibility for our shortcomings. We go on making up because that will help us rise above and overcome and go beyond our shortcomings. We continue making offerings of service with love as best we can, although we're very crippled. Okay, so I brought copies. Yes, we brought copies. So I'm going to do as I did it after the Sunday program in Naperville. I pretty much did what I did here. And I'm going to, I don't know, maybe sit right here, and if you want a copy, it's one of these cultural things. I'll sign it. Then you can have a signed copy, like somehow that makes it better or something. And the I don't know what the BBT price is, but their retail price suggested is $6, and we'll just, you take a copy for $5.
I'll give you a copy. I'll sign it while you're taking prasadam or something like that. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.